I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is school. In particular, the resources that are used in schools across the country and the ongoing discussion and debate surrounding their representation of Indigenous peoples and how the history of Indigenous peoples is taught to Canadians from the time that they enter public schools. And with schools letting out for summer break all across Canada, this is a good time to sit back and reflect on some of the materials that students are receiving when they go to class. And that is the subject of a book by Catherine LaRochelle entitled School of Racism, A Canadian History, 1830 to 1915, in which Catherine looks at the Quebec public school system and how it has taught and endorsed colonial principles to students. And in the book, Catherine focuses on the materials, the textbooks, the assignments, the things that teachers were giving to their students in both English and French language schools in Quebec through the period that she's studying, and looks at the ways that the material constructs and others non-white individuals in Canada and in Canadian history. It's a really interesting profile and a fascinating way to look at education, especially as we talk about on the show. Education is the ephemeral thing that you go to class, the class is taught, and then that's it. So really going in deep onto the materials that are used in classrooms, wonderful way to approach these questions while also seeing through the development of the public school system, how state actors are participating and engaging with these representations and reinforcing some of these colonial ideas. So the book was originally written in French, but Catherine, as she talks about on the show, really wanted to get this out in English as well because of how relevant it is to schools, both in Quebec and across the country, and that she does look at English language materials. And we do get in a little bit about how English language historians, French language historians in Canada, how they interact, or in a lot of cases don't interact and engage with each other's work. So this is a really wonderful example of what can be done when we look at both English and French language sources and publish and engage in both English and French. So I did have the chance to speak with Catherine. It was a little different. We were in Montreal for the Canadian Historical Association annual meeting. So we were sitting outside. So the sound is going to be a little different than what you're used to with us. But I was really pleased to get a chance to talk with her, meet her in person, and get this chance to sit outside on a very, very warm day in Montreal. But despite how uncomfortably warm it was a wonderful discussion. Think you will enjoy it. So let's get right into my chat with Catherine LaRochelle. All right, and Catherine LaRochelle joins me now. Catherine, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm very happy to have you here. So let's talk about the book, School of Racism, A Canadian History. As I said in the introduction, 1830 to 1915. So let's just start at the base level of why those year frameworks for the book. What's happening in Quebec at those times, and what is 1830 is a really good starting point for this analysis?
Yeah, I kind of have many dates while during the process of my PhD, it changed sometimes, and I finished with those dates. For 1830, it's for sure it's not a lot of material for those first decades, but it's the first attempts in Quebec at some kind of public education, and so we have also the first textbooks that are published and first kind of archives of school materials from students at that time. But the big part of my book, it's more about 1860s and until 1915. And so why 1915? That's kind of a easy one, that in the sense that I had to stop at one point. So not everything is changing in 1915, but there are still some changes that affect what I'm talking about in the book. So on the first hand, it's First World War. And so the concept of civilization and barbarity kind of changed, the meaning changed, and we see it in some new people that weren't in the defined as barbaric in 19th century. And also there's a rise of nationalism in education, and so the content, the school, the curriculum is more nationalist, and the figures of other kind of change spaces in schools. So for sure indigenous people still remain the principal figure of other, but the other figures tend to be on the missionary side, and so on kind of extracurricular school material.
So there's a couple things that I want to ask about from that. The first is just on an administrative point, right? Education in this country, post-Confederation, provincial, but given these year dates, you're going through Lower Canada, Canada East, and then into the province of Quebec. Administratively, what are the differences, if any, in the public school system and the materials that are coming out as you go through those political changes?
I was asked some of those questions during the process of evaluation and stuff like that, and it doesn't affect the topic of my book. The textbooks doesn't change. Some of the textbooks I used are in school from like the 1830s through the end of the century. So in this sense, the schools, infrastructure of this institution that changed with laws and the change of administrative frame doesn't affect the content that children are taught. So I kind of didn't.
That's an easy one.
I didn't put that in my study, but for sure maybe some stuff were affected, and that kind of I don't know how to say that in English, but angle mort of my study, but
And then I guess the other one is, I think for a lot of English Canadians and English Canadian historians, we would associate Quebec very closely with the Catholic Church. And so how much does religion play a role in the materials that are being produced, and what role does the church have in just generally the development of public education in this era?
A big role for sure, and this is a question I'm being asked kind of a lot in Quebec about this study. So and some commentators kind of associated the racism I found in the school system with the Catholic Church, so kind of a way to say that was the Catholic Church who were racist. And it's kind of yes and no, like they were, and everybody else also. I mean, it's not a discourse that is particularly associated with the church. And the first argument for that is that I found the same stuff in Protestant, English Protestant material, English Catholic material, and French Catholic material. So there are some stuff that is related to the fact that the Catholic Church was really a big player in this school system. But I think also in the middle of 19th century, the church is not already this big player. It kind of grow during this century, and at the beginning of the 20th one, it's really the major player. And so the discourse is a Christian discourse. So even if the textbook is from some congregation editing or not, it's from Protestant or Catholic, it's a Christian discourse that is present in other Christian societies at that time. So I don't think the fact that the church was at the top of many of those schools, or they were the teachers, influence the discourse. I mean, otherwise that the fact that the church was a really big player in that century in the West.
That does lead to the question, because you kind of mentioned it there, the difference between the materials that are being used and then what happens in the classroom, right? There's something ephemeral that So a teacher goes in, teaches a class, and then that's it, right? Then all we have is the memory of it. Mm-hmm. And the book, of course, relies on a lot of the textbooks and the physical, but were there ways that you could investigate and discuss, or how do you investigate and discuss how things are being used versus what is actually happening, or in terms of what's in the textbook compared to what's happening in the classroom, and how are there ways to really to pursue that line of inquiry?
There are some ways, for sure. It's 19th century, so we don't have those like memories from witness, but the composition, so the homeworks that students were doing in class or at home that many congregation kept were really a good way to see how much the teacher changed what was in the textbook or not, and it was not a lot, at least for the content I was looking for. Yeah. So they used the textbooks, they asked children to write about Turkey, and so it's the textbook. The answer is clearly just the textbook, but it's handwritten by a student. So this was one part, and then other kind of archives from student association, speech group circles and stuff like that, that kept minutes of their meetings, helps to see how this ideology was just really pervasive in many school settings that at first time I didn't thought about.
And for the material you're looking at, is it province-wide, is it throughout Quebec, or are there differences? Obviously there'd be language differences for the English language communities, French language communities, but generally speaking, are we looking at province-wide, or is there a difference from, you know, Quebec City and like South Shore versus closer to the Ottawa Valley and the west part of the province, or like what is sort of the management and what sort of province-wide stuff exists, if any?
I would say it's not just province-wide, but it's countrywide, and this is in part why the book in English is called A Canadian History, because for most part of the period I'm looking at, those textbooks were used in Ontario and Quebec, and for the Catholic part, it's much more which congregation was teaching your school that will affect what textbook you're using than the region of the province. So for French Canadian throughout the country, they were using the same textbooks, and for some part the old textbooks of Quebec that Quebec students were not using anymore were sent to the other part of the French Canada in Manitoba, New Brunswick and stuff like that. For some rural region where you have one school with every children in the same class, parents were complaining that each change of teacher were provoking a change in textbooks. So yeah, no, it's not like regional stuff. It's it's more wide and kind of each each case is particular.
Yeah, and that kind of speaks to something I did want to talk about, was the fact that this is a translated work into English, original in French. And before we get into some of the French language, English language divisions in just the literature in this country, why did you feel like, you alluded to it, but why did you feel like it was important to get this particular book out in English and go through all of the challenges and the hurdles, everything that comes with translating a book and getting it out? What made you want to push forward and see this through so that it was available in both French and English?
Yeah, I think I will go a little bit earlier in that story. So for the short story, at the beginning of my PhD, I was going to look at the French Canadian community of Quebec. And then I have this seminar with individual seminar with David Marin at the time. And I know, you know, I was reading literature on Quebec history, and I just found that it was this divide. There was English English Quebec history, and then the rest of Quebec history, which means French, French Quebec history. And I was just realizing that they didn't have a lot of dialogue. Sure. And so I realized that I was going to do that, exactly that. And the fact that looking at just one community, what you're finding, you will see that this is specific, mm-hmm. but you don't know.
And, how could you know?
Yeah. And so from that moment, when I realized I was going to do what I was critiquing, I decided to bring the English community also in my study. And this is the best decision I ever made. So thanks to Dave. Because this is what permit me to say that this is nothing specific to French Quebec. This is really a racist ideology that is shared countrywide between the two community, and there's less difference between those two community than some similarities in this discourse. And so from that time on, when I just did my defense, it was sure that I wanted to put this book in English, because I look at the English community, and so it was important for me to kind of reach this community of historians also, because I found that there's this divide in the literature. Right. Yeah.
That leads to a really important question, I think, that in this country, generally speaking, English-Canadian historians, and I'm going to generalize here, will say French Canada is Quebec and use those two mm-hmm. things as synonyms. And a lot of people will now put, instead of whatever their topic is, the subtitle will be, instead of in Canada, it will be in English Canada. And English Canadian historians don't do a great job of doing a lot of investigation interrogating French Canada. I don't know what the situation in reverse is, if French Canadian historians are better at investigating English Canada, but how do you see the relationship just in terms of the literature, and why is it important for French Canadian historians to be aware of and part of the literature in English Canadian history, and vice versa, for English Canadian historians to be more active in the French Canadian historiography and the literature?
I think the answer to that is more on a political level. So the fact that there's not this type of, I mean, this is a generalization, there's a lot of historians who are doing this this bridge, but the fact that we're so obsessed with this divide, be it the fact that they don't have a lot of conversation, or the fact that we're comparing the both, obscure all the rest of the stories we can tell about Canada, and all the relation to the wider world and stuff like that. And so I think the fact that I want to bring this story in both languages is more on the level, kind of a political level, to see like there's a lot of a common history we share. And I mean, more than just the political one, it's really similar. It's communities that are really similar in their fundamentals, origins, cultural one, and so we put a lot of energy to see the difference. That's fine. I mean, there are some, but we don't put a lot of energy to see what is common, and so that can help us understand settler colonialism in Quebec, which is really understudied. It can help also, understand the influence of Quebec culture in the rest of Canada also, in the residential schools.
Yep.
There were a lot of Quebec nuns and priests there. And so I think, kind of find it political to go like on upper level to see it as a community that share a lot.
In the Quebec or French, I should say, the French Canadian historiography, because in English Canada we do talk a lot about settler colonialism, and people are trying, I think, increasingly to include reconciliation as part of the histories that we're writing. how would you assess it in the French Canadian literature, just in general terms, as a topic of investigation, topic of study? Is it at the forefront? Is it developing in a way that is similar to what's going on in English Canada?
It's certainly developing. I mean, there's a lot of kind of young historians or established ones who are orienting their inquiries on this topic, but overall it is really understudied. And on this specific topic, I have an article that is going out now in the Canadian Historical Review. It is a special issue on race in Canada, race and racism. And I just looked at the, you know, there's a lot of also kind of backlash on those area of studies, and people talking about woke epistemology, and everything is about race now. And so I just looked at the five, so from 2017 to 2021, the Francophone literature on Quebec or Canada, to see if race is, you know, a topic that is really prevalent. And so there's almost nothing.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's some good stuff, but it is clearly not like the dominant area studies in French, no.
Let's get into some of what you're finding in these textbooks, specifically, like the classroom materials. Could you give us an example or two of the material, the racist material that you're finding in this, within the textbooks, and how you go about trying to peel things out, especially when I would imagine that a lot of it is layered within a colonial structure, and just how you go about trying to find that and what is actually in there.
Mm-hmm. So I've looked at the way the language and the curriculum creates otherness, and so and I found out that it is by racist ideology, and so for sure the fact that races are taught as a scientific fact is the first level. So it's something the children must learn from like third grade, and it's taught in a hierarchical way. So white race is at the top, and so it's explicit. And then in all the other subject, like French or English class, history for sure, but also religion, there's this hierarchy is transmitted in many ways and in some really mundane way. So in vocabulary exercise, right, you will have some exercise about the word savage or barbaric and stuff like that. And so this kind of way to see the world is really infused in the school system. And I had an historian in Quebec who he told me it's really interesting the fact that you didn't name the book Racism in School. And School of Racism, because it's really the school, I think, was really a prominent tool, right, for racism to be so, for his transmission to such a large part of the population, because it's at the same time that school start to be kind of every children pass through school at least some years, right. And so this way to see other people was really school was really, I mean, a tool for colonial. Sean Carleton say the same in his book in another way, but it's really an important tool for imperialistic enterprise at that time and colonialism.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm always curious about is how intentional is that, the sort of the Eurocentric side of things. And one of the examples is just the map, right, where a map has Europe right in the middle of it,
yeah,
and usually bigger proportionally than what it actually is. So that, like, just as one example of that. But sometimes I wonder about just the unconscious centering yeah. of a European mindset by people who are creating the system, because that's who they are. That's the environment that they're from, as opposed to intentionally trying to propagate this idea of white supremacy mm-hmm. and trying to center, like how do we try to assess that? Or how do you, in the book and in the materials, try to assess just what is kind of implicit racism versus explicit, and trying to situate the materials within that framework, if it matters at all?
Mm. I think most of what I'm looking at is implicit and unintentional in some ways, kind of unconscious discourse. But because I'm kind of looking at a system, and I think this is like what's coming on from my book. I'm not looking at some specific actors. Mm. I mean, there are some names of textbook authors, but I'm not looking at one in particular. And I'm looking at children who are kind of anonymous. I only have their names. And so what I'm trying to do is to see how this system is functioning.
Yeah.
And I think looking at some like specific person and intentional is really helpful, but it doesn't necessarily help us dismantle yeah. those systems, because if you kind of think you're not doing this intentional thing, you're okay.
Right, yeah.
And so I guess looking at how this unconscious material and discourse is transmit into some really, really banal and mundane ways help us see how we ourselves have been taught that in some ways, and how we can reproduce, or at least how it appears in our mind sometimes, yeah. Like in an instinctive way.
But yeah, it's there, right? It's just sort of instinct. It's
yeah.
part of, and one of the things that the book gets at is that these things become so deeply embedded that they're still present in
yeah.
some ways, or in a lot of ways even.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm curious about is, I mean, I went to public school.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume you went to public school. And a lot of the people in the historical community and people who address these things went to public school. So when these things become embedded, how hard is it to uproot them and to remove them and to challenge them when the system that we all mm-hmm. learn in has them? So even sometimes identifying them can mm-hmm. be challenging, because they're so deeply ingrained mm-hmm. that it can seem, well, that's just the way it is. So just in a sense of looking at it from a 2024 perspective mm-hmm. and moving forward, obviously we don't want to further propagate racist ideas, and we want to make sure that these things get out of the school system. But how difficult is it when, to a certain degree, everyone who's gone through public school is a product of it?
Yeah. And it's also difficult because sometimes when you want to dismantle it so much, you can just reproduce
yeah, right.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not just the fact. Sometimes it's, you know, there are some stuff that were invisible, and so you try to just represent more. Mm-hmm. But representing more is not necessarily a good representation, or it can transmit a lot of stereotypes. Like the indigenous people were really represented in 19th century textbooks. So that it's not a matter of like the quantity of representation or the diversity of representation. And I think the other difficulty is sometimes, you know, when I did this study, so it's been a couple of years since I finished it, and sometimes I just want to scrap everything. You know?
Right, yeah.
Everything seems so problematic, and you don't see how to solve it. Mm. But now I'm kind of thinking that, you know, you can have just dismantled this type of system in,
right, yeah.
you know, a year. But just the fact to, I think there's a lot in the teachers' formation that can help. Just the fact to be aware of those types of automatic
yeah.
representation, and the fact that sometimes when you have good intention, or you think you are doing a good representation, you can clearly fall into exotisms and fetishism of otherness also. Yep. And so I think I mean, this is the historical discipline, but just to have this critical mindset a little bit all the time, but not on the level that everything is just, it's kind of a difficult balance to have. But
So what would your advice be, if any? Again, historians tend to maybe not want to always do this, but what would your advice be to teachers potentially as they're reviewing their materials? Certainly there are some things that are mandated that I guess they have to use, but in general, when they do have discretion, like how would you advise teachers to incorporate some of what you found in the book so that they're not reproducing these things in their own classrooms?
I think a lot of material on indigenous people is problematic until now, even if it's done in some good intention ways. So I will be aware on this topic particularly to maybe try to have material produced by indigenous school centers or stuff like that, because this is I think really, really pervasive, the fact that we start about like talking about ethnographic stuff on indigenous people before the European whites come to America. And I see it because I have 3 kids in school system right now, so I see that this is the same kind of, you know, road, even if the content is not the same. So yeah, I will try to, you know, look at podcasts, at many children literature that is really good right now. And I know many teachers are doing that to kind of patch the fact that the curriculum is not right. and maybe going also with, you know, the children interest, the children questions, because a lot of time we are going ahead of what children will want to know or how they frame the world.
Right.
And so maybe, I know that's not always possible. Teachers have really a big job to do, but to start from their perspective or their questions on the world maybe can help.
Yeah, I guess, we don't really want to give teachers more to do necessarily.
Exactly.
They're already overburdened. But yeah, there's a lot there. And so again, we will encourage people to pick up the book. It is School of Racism, Canadian History, 1830 to 1915, available in both English and French. We'll link to the book in both languages down in the show notes. Catherine LaRochelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There you have it. My chat with Catherine LaRochelle. Again, I thank her for her time. And again, School of Racism, Canadian History, 1830 to 1915. And we will put the links to both the English and French language versions down in the show notes. And with that, let's get to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from Global News by Sam Thompson and Daisy Wolk from April 25th, 2024. Shock and disbelief after Manitoba school trustees' Indigenous comments. This is a story about a public meeting from the Mountain View School Division in Western Manitoba, where Trustee Paul Coffey gave a speech on the topic of racism and anti-racism, which has been widely criticized by a lot of local leaders. According to the story, Coffey suggested that residential schools served a good purpose. He dismissed land acknowledgments as blaming white people for taking the land of Indigenous people. He also noted that he refuses to use the term Indigenous, and also pushed back on signs about inclusivity, and says he refuses to use acronyms when discussing members of the LGBTQ2+ community. So the speech has been widely criticized by the community. We have some quotes from community members who heard the speech and who have been informed of the speech, and it's certainly surprising to hear that from a school board trustee, but given what we talked about with Catherine, perhaps not all that surprising. And it really gets into the core of what she's talking about when she suggests that these ideas are so deeply ingrained and how difficult it can be to push back against them and ultimately dismantle the colonial structures that exist in schools, as this is somebody who obviously had a very powerful position in the school board. And this is just one example in Western Manitoba, but if you go through and look at local reports from school boards across Canada, across the United States, you can see these types of comments coming from school board members, school board trustees. And again, it gets into the idea of just how deeply ingrained these thoughts, beliefs are, and how difficult it can be to address those. So encourage you to read that. And as I said, you can certainly find other stories like this across Canada and across the United States. So again, Shock and Disbelief After Manitoba School Trustees' Indigenous Comments by Sam Thompson and Daisy Wolk of Global News, today's historical headline of the week. With that, I'll say thank you very much, everybody, for listening. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, likes, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca, all the great written material over there on the website, plus all of our past episodes as we get into the summer here. Hope your summer's off to a wonderful start. We'll be with you all summer long for more What's Old is New.